Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namassami. So this is sutta number 30, the shorter discourse on the simile of the heartwood. And the reason I'm reading this out, because I was given a copy of all the talks which I had given and recorded. This one is not on that list, so this is why I'm reading it out today. I thought I'd done this before, but I can't remember doing it. It's not on the list, so here we go. And it's interesting, there's a little twist to this particular sutta, in that it does talk about the reason why we practice as Buddhists, and about virtue and concentration, or rather stillness and wisdom. But it has a little twist in the end where it singles out jhanas as if that's nothing to do with concentration, as if it's somehow superior. So let's see exactly how this all pans out, because it is an interesting little sutta. So here we go. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove and not at Pindaka's Park. And some of you have been there, and you know what it's like. It's beautiful parkland, and quite large, flat, and with beautiful trees, and not too far away from the town. So it's great to actually go in those pilgrimage places and see those places. You understand what a monastery would be like in the time of the Buddha. Really, really pleasant, like a parkland. It's more like King's Park than you would think of Bodhinyana Monastery or Dhammasara. That was the sort of places the monks would live. So one day, we'll have to sort of see if we can get King's Park for our next city centre. Then the Brahmin Pingala Kocha went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, now that's a sign that he wasn't a disciple of the Buddha, but he was still respectful enough to sit down at one side. Master Gotama, there are these recluses and Brahmins, which is the holy people at the time of the Buddha, each the head of an order, of a Sangha. So this is what a Sangha meant. It's Sangha, it's head of an order. The head of a group, the teacher of a group, a well-known and famous founder of a sect, regarded by many as saints. And what they meant by saints, it means they used this word, Titakara, they said, like a maker of a ford, like a bridge maker, to take you across from this world to whatever the next world is, whether it's Nibbana or Arahatship or whatever. A ford maker, a bridge maker. That was the word they used for saints. I know many of you know that actually the English word saint, you know, it comes from sanctus. It's the same root as santo, which means a peaceful one. So anyone who's really peaceful, that means that's the word saint. A saint should be to be a peaceful person. But anyway, they use the word saint here, but what it really meant was a ford maker. Someone, not meaning a car producer, but one who actually would take people across through their teachings from this shore to the other shore. That is Purana Kasapa, Makali Gosala, Ajita Kesa Kambaling, Pakuda Kachayana, Sanjaya Balatiputta and the Niganta Nataputta. And some of those became quite famous. I think it's Makali Gosala was the leader of what's called the Ajivakas. These were the naked ascetics. Sanjaya Balatiputta, that was Sariputta's former teacher. And when Sariputta and Moggallana, they went to join the Buddha, and they got sort of stream-winning with the Buddha, they went back to Sanjaya and said, why don't you come stay with this Buddha? It's really good. He said, no, I'm such a renowned teacher, I can't put myself under any other teacher. It was almost as if that pride stopped him going to see the Buddha. And lastly, Niganta Nataputta, also known as Mahavira, who was the founder of the Jains. So, of course, that time when the Buddha was around, it was actually quite an amazing time. In the same time, in the same locality, you know, were the founder of two of the major world religions, Jainism and Buddhism. They were contemporaries. They would have met each other, and certainly their followers would sort of argue with each other. So a major world religion, Jainism and Buddhism, arrived at the same time in the same area, which was amazing. Now, All these heads of groups or heads of sanghas, what we call like religious leaders, have they all had direct knowledge as they claim, or have none of them had direct knowledge, or have some of them had direct knowledge and some not? So it's just asking, what do you reckon about your adversaries? Are they enlightened or not? Some are, some not. What do you reckon? Yes. Direct knowledge means like real insight of the truth. Remember in those days that there was a common understanding that to be enlightened meant actually to direct knowledge of the truth. Direct means not accepting it from your teacher, not believing it because that's so tradition, but direct knowledge seen for yourself. So basically, have they all got that wisdom, seen things for themselves? Some have, some not. What do you reckon? And the Buddha was obviously very wise. He said, enough, Brahmin, let that be. All this, have they all had direct knowledge as they claim, or have none of them had direct knowledge, have some of them had direct knowledge and some not? Because sometimes you just sort of give us direct answer there, you're just creating controversy. So, you know, if somebody asks me just, you know, well, was Jesus enlightened? You know, was Muhammad sort of an arahat? Was, who else have we got? Moses. Was Moses a stream winner? And then instead of saying, oh, no way, they could be that. No, you don't say that. You say to the Christians, enough, Christian, let this be. I will teach you Dhamma. Yes. Anyway, the Buddha said, enough, Brahman, let this be. Have they all had direct knowledge as they claim, or have none of them had direct knowledge, or have some and some not? I shall teach you the Dhamma, Brahmin. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, sir, the Brahmin Pingala Kocha replied. The Blessed One said this, and this is an old simile. Suppose, Brahmin, a man or woman needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, came to a great tree possessed of heartwood. Passing over its heartwood, its sapwood, its inner bark and its outer bark, he would cut off its twigs and leaves, and take them away, thinking they were heartwood. Then a man with good sight, seeing him, might say, this good man did not know the heartwood, the sapwood, the inner bark, the outer bark, or the twigs and leaves. Thus, while needing heartwood and seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, he came to this great tree, standing possessed of heartwood, and passed over its heartwood, its sapwood, its inner bark and outer bark. He cut off its twigs and leaves and took them away, thinking they were the heartwood. Whatever it was this good man had to make with his heartwood, his purpose will not be served. And then, as all the, you get all the permutations here, suppose a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, passing over its heartwoods, its sapwoods, its inner bark, he would cut off his outer bark. And then, instead of just cutting off his outer bark, he needing heartwood, he passed over its heartwood, its sapwood, and cut off its inner bark. Passing over its heartwood, he cut off its sapwood and took that away, thinking it was the heartwood. Therefore, his purpose will not be served. And I've just done in very brief numbers 4, 5, and 6. Now, 7. Suppose a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, and cutting off only its heartwood, he would take it away, knowing it was heartwood. Then a man with good sight, seeing him, might say, this good man knew the heartwood, he knew the sapwood, he knew the inner bark, he knew the outer bark, he knew the twigs and leaves. Thus, while needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, he came to this great tree standing possessed of heartwood, and cut off only its heartwood, and took it away, knowing it was heartwood. Whatever it was this good man had to make with heartwood, his purpose will be served. So that simile, which the Buddha used several times, the tree, you know, the only part of the tree which you can really make use of is pith, you know, where the real wood is, the heartwood. And the thing which surrounds our heartwood, the sapwood, I mean, that's just too weak to make much out of. And then you've got the inner bark, the outer bark, You know, if you're making sort of cork, yeah, you get the outer bark. But he wasn't seeking for cork, he was seeking for the heartwood, and certainly not the sort of the twigs and leaves. You can't make much with that. So it's just understanding what the purpose, what the heartwood of this is. And so, having given that simile, the Buddha explains its meaning in paragraph 8. So too, Brahmin, here some clansman goes forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness. In other words, becomes a monk. Considering, I am a victim of birth, aging and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. So he said that's one of the main reasons why people become monks and nuns, or even why they become Buddhists. Because, you know, they've had enough about thinking that life is a bowl of cherries and everything is okay. You know, there's some suffering going on there. You want to do something about it. It's solving the eternal problem of a way out of suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. When he has gone forth thus, he acquires gain, honor, and renown. He is pleased with that gain, honor, and renown, and his intention is fulfilled. I've made it. I am popular. People know about me. I get invited to breakfast with the president of Sri Lanka. I have got my picture on books. And you have your fame. You have your honor. But I don't know where the gains went to. That means the money. So they always say this always comes together. I tell the monks this, it's supposed to be gains, honor, and fame. I've pretty much got the honor and fame, but where's all my gains gone? Just got this old bag with patches on it. Never mind. With all the gains, you know where the gains go to? They'll go to the Buddha Society, and you spend it all. Anyway. So sometimes your intention is fulfilled. On account of it, he lauds himself and disparages others. I have gain, honor, and renown, but those other monks, they're unknown, they're of no account. No, you are of renown, and you are of value, and you are of account, Venerable Jagannatha. So he arouses no desire to act, nothing to do further, he's just famous and that's it. He makes no effort for the realization of those other states that are higher and more sublime than gain, honor, and renown. So he hangs back and slackens. I say that this person is like a man needing heartwood who came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood. That's Buddhism, that's Dharma. This great tree possessed of incredible, powerful teachings, heartwood. And he passed over its heartwood. He passed over its sapwood. He passed over its inner bark. He passed over its outer bark. And he cut off only the twigs and leaves. Now, the gain, honor, and fame. And thinking they were the heartwood. And so whatever it was he had to make with the heartwood, you know, in other words, freedom from suffering, his purpose would not have been served, you know, in suffering by becoming famous or having lots of things. You know, that's an important thing for monks and nuns to always remember. That's not what we came here for. And the Buddha, actually, he had this dream. I think, what was the dream again? That he was on top of a big part of shit, wasn't it? Big part of dung. And he said, but he wasn't touched by that dung. He wasn't soiled by it. He said, that's the gain, honor, and fame, which will come to him in the future. But he realized he wouldn't be touched by that. So you've got to be very, 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 very careful. Because you know what happens. If you have got any honor or fame, sooner or later you lose it. And sooner or later someone, any praise, you'll always have dispraise. Any sort of fame, people will try and cut you down. So that's why it's a stupid thing to have. So, and also, if that's what you think that this is all about, you know, for you or others to be the smartest Buddhist in the whole lay community, the BSWA, so people know you as an expert, then that's not what this is all about. That's just taking away the twigs and leaves, and it means if you're satisfied with that, you will not put forth any effort to do anything more. So here, Brahmin, and obviously this is in the context of those leaders of other religions. Leaders of other religions are often just content with the praise. They made it. I'm a pope. I'm an archbishop. I am a whatever else it is. And you don't go any further than that. So here, Brahmins, some clans person goes forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, considering I'm a victim of birth, aging, and death, soul lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I'm a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely the ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. When he's gone forth thus, he acquires gain, honor, and renown, but he's not pleased with the gain, honor, and renown. His intention is not fulfilled. That's not why he became a monk. So he does not, on account of the gain, honor, and fame, laud himself and disparage others. Instead, he arouses desire to act, and he makes an effort for the realization of those states, those other states that are higher and more sublime than gain, honor, and renown. He does not hang back and slacken. He achieves the attainment of virtue, which is the next stage after gain, honor, and renown, of virtue. He is pleased with that attainment of virtue, and his intention is fulfilled. On account of it, he lauds himself and disparages others. I am virtuous, of good character, but those other monks are scallywags, immoral, of evil character. So you're just praising yourself because of the virtue. So he arouses no desire to act, he makes no effort for the realization of those other states that are higher and more sublime than the attainment of virtue. He hangs back and slackens. I say that this person is like the man kneading heartwood, who passes over its heartwood, its sapwood, and its inner bark, cut off the outer bark, and took that away, thinking it was heartwood. And so whatever it was he had to make with the heartwood, his purpose would not have been served. So there, the outer bark, the virtue. So again, it's not just through virtue, even though that virtue will send you to a heavenly rebirth. And it's a good thing, but it's not the main purpose. It's not the heartwood of the tree of Buddhism, just to be a good person, a virtuous person, and a kind person, a person always serving other people, who's always very, very good, and who's a beacon of virtue into the world. It's a very wonderful thing to have people who can inspire others just by their goodness and their kindness. But that is not the purpose of the holy life. It is not the heartwood of a tree. So you've got to be careful that even if you're a virtuous person, really good, very kind, very compassionate, and you're inspiring others by your virtuous compassion and hard work, you should not be satisfied with that. Now, you had your hand up. Yes. It is, yes. But so you want to actually to go further than that. But again, how you achieve further than that. Remember, especially for virtue, that is a sort of a saying no to all of those tendencies of, you know, greed and hatred, which make you break your precepts. So it's very clear the desire to act to keep virtue is very much a restraining attitude, a stopping attitude. But still we say desire to act. Put forth effort to say no to, you know, wanting the glass of whiskey, no to lying. And it's, you just have to put effort to do that. Effort to say no. Does that answer your question? Okay. So 10. Here. Okay, here we go. 10. Here, Brahmin, some clansman goes forth out of faith and home life into homelessness, considering I am a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. When he has gone forth thus, he acquires gain, honor, and renown. He is not pleased with that gain, honor, and renown. His intention is not fulfilled. He achieves the attainment of virtue. He is pleased with that attainment of virtue. But his intention is not fulfilled. He does not, on account of it, laud himself and disparage others. He arouses desire to act, and he makes an effort for the realization of those other states that are higher and more sublime than the achievement of virtue. He does not hang back and slacken. He achieves the attainment of concentration or stillness. He is pleased with that attainment of stillness, and his intention is fulfilled. On account of it, he lauds himself and disparages others. Thus, I have a still mind, my mind is unified. But those other monks and nuns and lay people with their mind, but these other are unconcentrated, they're not still, their minds astray. So he arouses no desire to act, he makes no effort for the realization of those other states that are higher and more sublime than the attainment of stillness. He hangs back and slackens. I say that this person is like the man eating heartwood, who, passing over its heartwood and its sapwood, cuts off his inner bark and took it away thinking it was heartwood. And so whatever it was he had to make with a heartwood, his purpose will not have been served. So even deeper than virtue is the stillness. Now, I'm not sure if you notice this, but if you go back to the middle of paragraph 10, it says, he acquires gain, honor, and renown. He is not pleased with the gain, honor, and renown. He achieves the attainment of virtue. He is pleased with the attainment of virtue, but his intention is not fulfilled. He said, whatever, it's good to be pleased with the virtue. You're pleased with it, but you're not totally satisfied. With the gain, honor, and renown, the good monk nun is never pleased with the gain, honor, and renown, realizing that it is a great danger. So in Buddhism, we're always taught as monks to gain honor and renown. Be very careful. That's a very slippery slope for monks and nuns, or for anybody, when you get gain, honor, and renown. That's why it's really great being with monks and being with you guys. If I ever get up myself, you will always pull me down. Thank you very much. So we've got to be careful of that, because many people lose it. So this is stillness, and it's saying here that some people, they get stillness and they're just pleased with that. They think that's it. And on account of that, they praise themselves and they put down others. And you see that this is what we called, or what a person called, spiritual materialism, where you use your attainment of virtue or your attainment of meditation to actually praise yourself and put down others. And I've seen that happening all the time. Oh, those guys in that other tradition, they can't meditate, they just fall asleep. And all that sort of negativity, putting down, that's always a sign of great stupidity, and it's never encouraged here. So a person who has virtue, they know that's not the end. They never sort of put down people without virtue. Later on we'll find a person who has concentration or stillness, they don't put down people who have not got stillness. They don't sort of use this as an arrogant means to putting down others. They don't sort of make that as another sort of attainment for their self to raise themselves and disparage others. You got another one? Okay, Daniel. Well, I think you'll find that answer, you're talking about my teaching of like the not doing, letting be, as being the right effort here. And you find out in a bit moment that this stillness which is mentioned here is obviously far less than the jhanas. If somebody is getting reasonably still in their meditation and thinks this is good enough, at least you're, you know, focused, say, on the breath or something. So you can stay with the breath, you're nice and peaceful, but you're not into the jhanas yet. So as you'll see later on, that this degree of samadhi is not at that jhana level. So you're not even deep enough yet. But you're satisfied, oh, this is good. And you don't even try or aspire. Instead you just think how great you are and you criticize others. You just got what they got here called the inner bark. Number 11, here, Brahmin, some clansman goes forth out of faith in the home life into homelessness, considering, I am a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. When he has gone forth thus, he acquires gain, honor, and renown. He is not pleased with that gain, honor, and renown, and his intention is not fulfilled. He achieves attainment of virtue. He is pleased with the attainment of virtue, but his intention is not fulfilled. He does achieve the attainment of concentration, but she is pleased with that attainment of concentration, but her intention is not fulfilled. They do not, on account of it, praise themselves and disparage others. Instead, they arouse desire to act and make an effort for the realization of those other states that are higher and more sublime than the attainment of stillness. They do not hang back and slacken, and they eventually achieve the knowledge and vision. They are pleased with the knowledge and vision, and their intention is fulfilled. On account of this, they praise themselves and disparage others thus. I live knowing and seeing, in other words, I am wise and enlightened, but these other monks, nuns, lay people, they live unknowing and unseeing, so they arouse no desire to act. They make no effort for the realization of those other states that are higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. They hang back and slacken. I say that this person is like the man eating heartwood, who passing over its heartwood, cut off its sapwood, and took it away thinking it was heartwood. And so whatever it was he had to make with the heartwood, his purpose will not be served. So this is getting very deep now. Now we've gone through virtue, usually the samadhi, the stillness, and this knowledge and vision, which is usually wisdom. But the Buddha is saying here, this is not enough yet. Now remember the original question. He said, these other great teachers, they have knowledge and vision, they have wisdom, they have understanding. So remember, it's in that context that whatever the stillness was, it wasn't really all that still. Whatever the knowledge and vision was, it wasn't that which ended all suffering. Something less. And that's fascinating to know, because sometimes if it's very easy to think you're still, very easy to think you're wise, but you haven't really got to the heart of it. You're still on the surface, on the bark and sapwood. Yes. Yes. Aha. Let's call it, just for the sake, you ask me what knowledge and vision is, let's call it insight. Insight into many things. So, remember, this is a bit sort of cheeky, but many people do insight meditation. And many people actually have a degree of samadhi and stillness, but it's not all that deep. And they have insights based on that not so deep stillness. And sometimes they take that insight as all they need to do. Many people think that they're stream winners or they know what's going on. And therefore they don't put any effort, any sort of inclination to actually to go deeper. They say that my samadhi is enough, my stillness is sufficient. So they never even aspire for jhanas. In fact, sometimes they say it's not important. The knowledge and vision, they think, well, this is just crazy wisdom, this is the way things are. And they never even bother actually to see deeper. And they even say things like, non-self is, the Buddha never taught non-self. Anatta, it's just a strategy, it's just one way of looking at things. But, really, the secret is there is a self. Oh, no, not supernormal powers. This has like just the insights which sometimes people say they have when they don't. I remember this is going back to those other teachers who were obviously inspiring people because they inspired, they were charismatic, they could give talks and people thought they were wise. Thought they did have insight. They could have knowledge and vision into what enlightenment was and what sort of suffering was. Because each one of those teachers claimed that. So all those teachers, they claimed knowledge and vision. They claimed enlightenment in their own form. So the Buddha was saying they thought they were enlightened, and they very easy that when you in one form of enlightenment, if it's really enlightenment, you will never do this. Some people think they're enlightened and they go praising themselves. I am enlightened. Not like those Jains. They don't know what enlightenment means. They're just stupid. And how do you think they can get enlightened that way? No way. And you can see that sometimes people who think they have these attainments, one of the signs that they haven't is that they praise themselves and they put down others. That's a sort of a dead ringer sign they haven't seen anything yet. And that's one of the things which comes out of a sutra like this. Okay, so let's see the person who gets the heart word. See what it is. Here, Brahmin, some clansman goes forth out of faith from home life into homelessness, or some woman goes to become a nun, and they consider, I'm a victim of birth, aging, and death, of soul lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I'm a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. When he has gone forth thus, they acquire gain, honor, and renown. They're not pleased with that gain, honor, and renown. Their intention is not fulfilled. They achieve the attainment of virtue. They're pleased with that attainment of virtue. It's good, it's inspiring, but your intention is not fulfilled. That's not why I became a monk or a nun for. You achieve the attainment of stillness. You are pleased with that attainment of stillness, but your intention is not fulfilled. This is the means to an end. It's not the end. You achieve knowledge and vision. You get some insights, some really sort of deep insights coming up. You are pleased with that knowledge and vision, but your intention is not fulfilled. That hasn't stopped suffering yet. You do not, on account of that, lord yourself and disparage others. You arouse desire to act and make an effort for the realization of those other states that are higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision, and you do not hang back and slacken. But what, Brahmin, are the states that are higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision? And here you see the jhanas and the arupas. Now that's a very strange way that this sutta actually runs, because usually the jhanas and the arupas are part of the stillness. So the only way you can really understand this, especially in the context of talking about those other teachers, yeah, they did have a degree of virtue. Yeah, they did have a degree of stillness. Yeah, they did have some insights. But it wasn't the full one. To get the full one, what is higher and more sublime than that type of knowledge and vision, the jhanas are what comes afterwards. As I will soon explain. Yes. Remember that all words have to be taken in context. As when I learned Pali, I learned it from the books of Professor A.K. Warder. And they said, look, the unit of reality is a sentence, not a word. So you have to look, the sentence is the unit of reality. If you take the words out, you're taking them out of context. So it's knowledge and vision, it's just a word. In the sentence, in the paragraph, it forms. That is what is the unit of truth. So we actually convey sentences, we don't convey words. And that's one of the problems that they always said, if you're translating from Pali into English or from Sinhala into Thai or whatever, never translate the words, translate the sentences. And the old one is, it rained cats and dogs. You translate that into Polish and it's totally stupid. So you just say, you know, it rained heavily, because that's what it means. You translate the sentence, not the words. And so here, that knowledge and vision, that is not just, you can't isolate that out of its context. So in this context, the actual sentence obviously means something much less, you know, than what that is pointing to in other contexts. And this is actually what he was saying, that this is the teacher from the other traditions. A very good indication was of in the Citta Sanyutta, in the Sanyutta Nikaya, Citta was a householder. And he was a very well-known man. And he went to go and see one of these teachers, Nigantha Nataputta Mahavira. And by this time he was already a disciple of the Buddha. And when he came up to see Nigantha Nataputta, Nigantha Nataputta said, oh, here comes one of those Buddhist disciples. You know, so these are crazy people. You know, they actually think that, you know, through meditation you can stop the mind flowing, that you can actually be still. And he said, that's just like putting your fist in the Ganges and trying to stop the current. You just can't do that. Your mind will always be moving. It's its nature.
And then he said to Chittu, he said, do you believe that you can stop the mind like that? And Chittu said, sir, I don't believe it can be done. And there you are. This is a senior disciple of the Buddha. And he says the Buddha's wrong. He says, you know, it cannot be done. You just heard him. He said he doesn't believe it can be done. See? And then Chittu said, sir, I don't believe it can be done. I know it can be done. And there's a great difference between belief and knowing. I know it can be done because I can get into the four jhanas. These disciples of the Buddha are tricksters. It's not easy to have a conversation with them. So he actually tricked sort of Dataputta by making that distinction between belief and knowing. He doesn't believe it. He knows it. Just like people ask me, do you believe in reincarnation? I don't believe in reincarnation. I know it's a fact. There's a total difference there. But what that was very interesting from that was Nigantha Nataputta obviously never knew about the jhanas. He thought they were impossible. And you know, if that sutta is to be taken as fact, you can see that the jhanas were beyond these other teachers. They even didn't think, they thought it was actually impossible to do that, to stop the mind. So you can see, yes, they had stillness, but they couldn't have the full stillness of the jhanas. Yeah, they can have knowledge and vision, but it wasn't based on the deep meditation experiences. Therefore, they passed over the real heartwood. So remember, we're now going to the heartwood. But what Brahmin are the states that are higher and more sublime than this knowledge and vision I've just talked about? Here, Brahmin, quite secluded from the five senses, secluded from the unwholesome states, meaning the five hindrances, a meditator enters upon nibbāsa in the first jhana, which is accompanied by movement of mind onto and holding the object, with the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion from the five senses. Now that's my translation, and that's an accurate one. This is a state higher and more sublime than this knowledge and vision. Than this knowledge and vision we've just been talking about. It's not higher than the enlightenment knowledge and vision, but it's something higher than the knowledge and vision which the Buddha has just been referring to. Yes. Okay, you've heard it many times, this is for others. Here, Brahmin, quite secluded from the five senses, not sensual pleasures, the five senses. As talking with Ajahn Bhumali, who's helping Bhikkhu Bodhi, he's doing the editing for the new translation of the Anguttara Nikaya, which is about a year away from publication. It's getting closer and closer. It's a huge amount of work. And he was talking to me that, he said, that particular form of Pali, it's the word K-long-A-M-A, karma. He said, in its singular, it can mean sense pleasures. But in its plural, it always means the five senses. The five senses, the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And it's important to actually to put that down. Because then it becomes clear, first jhana secluded from the five senses. This is just one of the signs you're in a jhana. You can't see anything, you can't smell, taste, but also you can't hear and you can't feel your body. So if somebody picked you up, if they touched you, you wouldn't know it. If someone shouted at you, Pauline, Pauline, you wouldn't hear them, even if they had your mouth in your ear. That is one of the great signs, very clear signs of a jhana. So people who say, yeah, they can feel their body, that's not in the jhana. So they can hear sort of the traffic in the background, that's not a jhana. This is what it says here, secluded from the five senses. But when you have the translation from sensual pleasures, that's not that hard to do. You have all your sensual pleasures and then they don't come up for a while. You're satisfied, just like you've had a good meal, you're not hungry. So secluded from sensual pleasures, that's a pretty easy one to have. But the five senses, that's much harder, but much easier to know whether you're secluded from the five senses or not. That's the real meaning of it, secluded from the five senses. Secluded from unwholesome states, that does refer to the hindrances. They're unwholesome, akusala. a monk enters, or meditator enters upon the abodes in the first jhana, which is accompanied a blight and sustained thought. There is no thought possible in jhana. You let go of that a long time before. That, as you heard, it's the mind is actually moving onto the object, which is bliss, and holds that bliss. The moving onto the bliss is called vitaka. The holding it is vichara. Causes an instability, but only a mild wobble, as I say. That's what is here said, is accompanied by applied and sustained thought. No way can there be any thought there at all. That's just a very rough part of the mind. But the last part, perfect with rapture and pleasure, born of that seclusion from the five senses. Just basically, just these five senses and the body, they just so irritating, as you well know. And if it's a wonderful, if you could turn off the sight, the sound, the smell, taste, touch off the body, so you can't feel the body for a while. No aches, no pains, no hurt, no cold, no tiredness. Body's gone. Bye-bye. Good riddance. Blissing out, just like this big burden has gone from you. And that's where the pleasure comes from. No thoughts, yeah. That is this thing, this movement of the mind onto the object, which holds onto the object. It's vitaka vichara, again, just like we were saying before, in different contexts, those words mean different things. Now those words actually do mean thought, an exploration of thought. In just one context, but it's very clear in the context of the jhanas, they mean something very different. And as I may have mentioned to you, that the monks who are comparing the versions of these suttas in the Chinese agamas just literally means what's come down, the tradition. That's the same word as our Pitaka. They looked at these Chinese translations. And surprise, surprise, they noticed that the Chinese characters for vitaka vichara, when it means thinking, are one set of characters. And when they refer to jhanas, they're a different set of characters. Whoever did that translation from the original Sanskrit or Pali into the Chinese, they also understood that vitaka vichara means one thing in one context, and in jhana it does not mean thinking. It just means a subverbal movement of the mind. Subverbal means it's not thinking as we know it. So you're silent, but the mind isn't perfectly still. The mind is still having a movement. What I've called a wobble. Because a wobble is one of the most finest types of movement. But let's put this into context with the second jhana. Again, this is paragraph 14, with a stilling, great word, the stilling of this movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object, what we call the wobble of the first jhana. When that stops, the meditator enters upon and abides in the second jhana. Self-confidence, you all know there's no self. Self-confidence, what that's referring to is that you are, in that sense, confident enough that not needing to hold that bliss, you just totally let it be. Whenever you let things go and let things be, it does need that trust, that confidence, it's going to be okay, it's going to be even better. Because that confidence is actually what overcomes that tiny fear, which makes you just hold on to that object slightly too much, so it's not stable. So when you have that inner confidence, it's not really self, it's inner confidence, ajata sampasadanam. Ajata means inside. That inner confidence that you don't need to hold. You just let go and it becomes very still. The same sort of confidence which I've told many of you during meditation retreats, that all you need to do is like driving your car and you have enough inner confidence to let go of the steering wheel. And let go of the pedals. And you just go perfectly. It's the same inner confidence that I've seen babies have in their mother's arms. And their mothers are just going through the shopping center, just, you know, buying this and buying that, and the baby's fast asleep. If I was in that mother's arm, I'd be terrified she's going to drop me. I would never go to sleep. But the baby is such confidence, it totally lets go and goes to sleep. And you've seen that many times. It surprises me how they can do that. It's just that inner confidence. And that same inner confidence which can let go that little bit more so all doing stops. That's the so-called self-confidence. Singleness of mind, that's the oneness of mind. It means nothing's moving. It's single in time. Without this movement of mind, with a rapture and pleasure born of stillness. And this is obvious in this context why concentration just misses the point far too much. You replace that word with stillness. There's no movement of mind anymore. So when there's no movement of mind, it's stillness. That's why stillness is a much, much, much better translation of samadhi. That's the second jhana, and it's known for being absolutely still, no movement of mind left. And it's a pleasure born of stillness. All this movement, going, coming, now that is something you see as suffering. And again with a stilling, and again with a fading away as well of rapture. Now you've got the pleasure, rapture and pleasure born of such stillness. Now the rapture fades. I think I mentioned to you in some retreats and some talks that whatever doesn't move, it just stays pretty still, soon fades away. There's a part of that pleasure which is not moving, the rapture part, and it just fades. You don't notice it anymore. It disappears. So the fading away as well of rapture, a meditator abides in equanimity, mindful and fully aware. I always pause to mention the fully aware and mindful because some people mistake these jhanas for trances. In a trance, you're not fully aware, you're not mindful. All these meditation states, you are highly aware, you're incredibly mindful. You're fully aware, it says here. And that's a great difference. If you're sort of dull, so that was really peaceful, but not quite sure what was going on, that can't be a jhana because you're not fully aware. Still feeling pleasure, now with the body, the word kaya, the body, is used in so many different contexts. And this does not mean the physical body. In the same way that lawyers have a body of evidence. And a body of evidence is not a group of human beings. It is just an accumulation of things. What it means here is you're feeling, where is it gone? Feeling pleasure with that experience. The body is well gone by now. You enter upon an abide in the third jhana, on account of which no one announced you have a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and mindful. This too is a state higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. And again, with the abandoning of that pleasure and pain, this is a long time ago, and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, that's the mental pleasure and pain, joy and grief, the meditator enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure. That's his object, his equanimity, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. This is when mindfulness goes to its peak. It's pure now. This too is a state higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. This is the fourth jhana. Now the arupas, again with the complete surmounting of perceptions of form, with the disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact, with non-attention to perceptions of diversity, aware that space is unbounded, the meditator enters upon and abides in the base of unbounded space. And this is where any perception of space now begins to disappear. In the same way that I've used the simile, and I haven't come across a better simile yet, the only way to understand these immaterial attainments, or one way to understand them, is to remember your experience when you go into present moment awareness. This is where time stops being bounded by being marked. And in that present moment, you can look at it two ways. There's no time at all there. You're squashed between the past and the future, just in this moment, which has got no dimension to it, no place to move. It's just so tight. So it's no time. But the experience inside that present moment is as if you've got all the time in the world. It's infinite. This also draws together that mathematical truth that zero and infinity actually lie so close together. Infinite space means also no space. It's where space begins to vanish. And this is what's happening. The whole concept of space vanishing. By completely surmounting the base of vanishing space, I'm just changing it now, aware that consciousness is vanishing, the meditator enters upon and abides in the base of vanishing consciousness, just like vanishing time. This too is a state higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. By completely surmounting the base of vanishing consciousness is gone now, just aware there's nothing. The meditator enters upon abides in the base of nothingness. This too is a state higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. Again, by completely surmounting the base of nothingness, the meditator enters upon and abides in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This too is a higher state and more sublime than knowledge and vision. This is the fourth arupa. So what's happening here? Things are vanishing fast. So first of all, the consciousness has vanished, and then what you're aware of? Nothing. But you're aware of that nothing, and soon that nothing vanishes. So what you're aware of, this is not even aware, non-perception, but you're aware of non-perception. This is the awareness of non-perception. That's why it's neither perception nor non-perception. When that goes, again, by completely surmounting the base of neither perception nor non-perception, the meditator enters upon the bias and the cessation of all perception and feeling. This is when it stopped, it's gone, finished. And the taints are destroyed by seeing with wisdom. This too is a higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. These are the states that are higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. I say that this person, Brahman, is like a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, who came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, and cutting off its heartwood, took it away, knowing it was heartwood. And so whatever it was he had to make with heartwood, the purpose will have been served. And it is the jhanas which lead to the abandoning of those taints. These are the outflowings. I like the word outflowing because many of you, especially when you are in the process of meditating, can actually observe your mind going out, flowing out into the past, flowing out into the future, flowing out into your body and into the world outside with your work and your family and your finances and your health, flowing outwards. And when the mind flows outwards, this is where it seeks the sensory experience, but it also flows outwards because that manifests your existence. When you flow out, you are. When you stop at home, you start to fade away and disappear. When those asavas, those outflowings stop, you don't go anywhere, you don't move. You're still. And this is where samsara ends, when the mind doesn't go out anywhere. It's very hard to qualify that. The only way to explain it is to understand the experience of sensory experience, either from what's watching and what you're observing, the observer and the observed. So what is happening here, that the observer is watching things vanish, and when things vanish, so does the observer vanish. It's as if what you observe disappears first, and then you, the observer, have got nothing to watch, and so you turn off. A good example of that is like in the Zen monasteries. I remember going to a retreat in one in the north of England once, where we weren't supposed to close our eyes. We
turn around and face a wall with our eyes open and just meditate. And what happened there was you're watching that wall and the wall disappeared. So because it didn't move, it was always the same. Just you got that, no, it's only a psychological experience. It's just neurological, nothing sort of supernatural. It's just you can't see a wall anymore because nothing's happening, it turns off. So you're seeing the vanishing of a wall. So first the object disappears, and then afterwards your sense of sight turns off. So first the object of consciousness vanishes, and then that particular type of consciousness which was observing it turns off afterwards. So if you can see just that second arupa, just you're watching the fading away of consciousness, but your consciousness is still there. That particular consciousness which can see the vanishing of consciousness then turns off. And then it's watching nothing. And then that consciousness which can see nothing, then when the nothing disappears, that consciousness which sees nothing disappears. And then you've got this non-perception. It's absolutely not even nothing. Nothing is not an object anymore. The object called nothing has vanished. And now the object of non-perception is there. And when that turns off, that's when your last and most subtle form of conscious experience turns off. That's the only way we can explain it. Yes. Knowledge and vision, in those particular states, the knowledge and vision just basically does not exist within those states because they're too stupid. Sorry, can you repeat that? Yeah, the mind can actually stop there. It's just a peaceful state. It won't go any further. Sometimes it goes further, sometimes it doesn't. So you obviously look at why that happens. Why do you go deeper into those experiences? One way is because you made that aspiration beforehand. It's as if you told the mind just to let go that little bit more. In other occasions, it might be just even though you don't make a specific aspiration to go into fourth jhana, you've just got such a momentum of letting go that what you've done that such a long time that it becomes automatic pilot once you're within the jhanas. Automatic pilot means you just keep letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go. But it's not something you choose. It's an automatic pilot. You set the controls, you put the program in, and now it just happens. So that's the only way it can be done. But there cannot be any decision made within the jhanas to go from one jhana to another. Volition, yes. Because volition is what makes the mind move. Oh, absolutely, yes. Within that. Yeah, I think so, but all the cravings, you say, if we have the craving to be, we can't get in the second jhana. All those cravings, they're only temporary. They come up and they go, and they come up and go. And so they're not sort of something, the latent tendency to crave is always there, but the actual manifestation of the craving, sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. And so you can still get into the second jhana, you know, but then afterwards you come out again, your craving hits you big time, you know, after a while. So you can still do it. You can still suppress the craving. You can still, even what some people do, it's not to be recommended, but you satiate your craving, so it's quite happy, and it gives you the opportunity just to go into these jhanas and say, oh, I've had enough for now. You can just go off and do jhanas, but I'll be back later to ask for some more sensory pleasures, please. Yeah.
No. No, you can do it, because even if you have the wrong views or the view that, yeah, there is a real self in here and that self is going to be permanent, even if you have that view, that nevertheless you can still enter those jhanas, because you're just basing that particular view. No, that particular view becomes inactive. It's not operating right now. Stubbornness. Sometimes the stubbornness of you can be there, but you know, sometimes even with stubbornness, sometimes you can get around, you can sneak around it. And sometimes, you've got that stubborn view, but you're meditating and things are happening and you enjoy it. And there's other things which are more important than your view. The very fact is very peaceful, very profound, even very pleasurable. And that can sometimes take you in, despite yourself. But what happens afterwards if you do have that stubborn view and you get into these jhanas? After all, when you emerge, your view is challenged. See, my goodness, that surprises me. And then actually you start to look at yourself in a different way. One of the reasons why these jhanas are powerful is because they're strong enough to kick the arse of stubborn view, if you don't mind me saying a sort of a coarse word, and really sort of to bust up stubborn view. Because arguments and logic and reason, that doesn't really change stubborn view. But the jhanas do. You have direct experience. That's one of the reasons why these jhanas are said to be a state higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. Higher and more sublime than insight. Because these are experiences, very powerful experiences. Somebody was telling me yesterday, they said that they met a friend who was another theoretical physicist. And where was he teaching? He's teaching, I think over in London University or somewhere. Anyway, I know it's in the United States somewhere. A theoretical quantum physicist. And he asked him, are you really a scientist or a philosopher? Because, you know, many stuff which you find from quantum physics actually changes just the way you look at the world. And it's much closer to philosophy than science. And in fact, in Cambridge, you know, theoretical physics was called natural philosophy. So many of those ideas which philosophers try to work out, through something like quantum physics, you can actually see far deeper into philosophy because you've got actually evidence, data, experience. In the same way that you can use that science, and you know, you can answer such questions. You know that old riddle, if a tree falls in a forest and no one is there to hear it, has it really fallen? And that's actually answered by quantum physics. You say it's neither fallen or not fallen, it's in that intermediate state. Now that is illogical for most people, but that is truth. That's the way things are, according to quantum physics. However, it's answering philosophy. In the same way, when you get into these jhanas, you actually see things, this can't be true. You know, this is not how my reason and logic told me things were. When you actually experience it, it shows you just how limited your views and understandings of the world were. And also you understand what I keep on saying, and people argue with me, but unfortunately what I'm saying is true, that some, without those jhanas, you just can't see this. You can't see the sort of what the will is, you can't see what consciousness is, and you can't even accept the very possibility there's nobody in here. That's why the insights which are based on those lower states of stillness, the knowledge and vision which the Buddha was talking about before, is inferior to these experiences which give you access to the real higher knowledges and visions of what it's like to have no will and still be mindful. To know what it's like to just have a consciousness fading away, a mind which is disappearing and getting more and more profound and more blissful. This is where you understand what enlightenment is. You know that many times that's one of the questions people ask you, what is enlightenment? Can you please explain nirvana? And I've always explained, you know, the five kids playing the wishing game. It gives you an indication. But if you really want to find out what nirvana is like, you just go to the first jhana. And the Buddha actually said, even that experience, the pleasure, the feeling you experience there, he called it sambodhisukha, enlightenment happiness. So even the Buddha pointed out that that experience of jhana gives you a direct taste of enlightenment. So that's actually how we know, that's why these are higher knowledges, that are more sublime than the knowledge and vision you've had before. Now this, I'll just finish it off now. I say that, number 22, I say this person, Brahmin, is like a man eating heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, who came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, and cutting off his heartwood, he took that away, knowing it was heartwood. And so whatever it was he had to make with heartwood, this purpose would have been served. So this holy life, Brahmin, does not have gain, honour and renown for its benefit, or the attainment of virtue for its benefit, or the attainment of stillness for its benefit, or knowledge and vision as its benefit, but these higher ones. Through the jhanas, that unshakable deliverance of mind, that is the goal of this holy life, its heartwood and its end. When this was said, the Brahmin Pingala Kocha said to the Blessed One, "Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama, Master Gotama has made the Dharma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. From today let Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life." So instead of answering the question, are all those other teachers, you know, enlightened? He was saying what knowledge and vision was, and how it's attained, and how the person who is enlightened, he doesn't put down other people. The Buddha never said, "I am enlightened," but those other scallywags, no way are they enlightened. He said, "I'll teach you the Dhamma, you know, what knowledge and vision is, and just what real knowledge and vision is, through the jhanas." So that's the way I understand that sutta. Yes, Dania? You're saying wisdom, okay. I think I understand what you're meaning. You're saying sometimes a person can just get the first jhana and they can become fully enlightened as a result of it. So. They can after the second jhana, of course they can. So the destruction of the asavas of full enlightenment can happen after any jhana, but not without a jhana. And I think the reason is because I go back to that simile of the 1,000-petal lotus, and just once, you know, the body has disappeared, and the 5 senses have disappeared, then at least you know something about what disappearance is. You know what the mind is when it's not encumbered, not connected to the 5 senses, and you've seen the disappearance of fading away, and just that much is enough for those with strong influence to realize you've got enough information now, the minimum amount to use your wisdom to see that, well, if this body and its five senses, which I couldn't see before, could actually totally vanish, you know, then perhaps everything else can vanish. And obviously in the second jhana you see the will vanishing. And this will can vanish, maybe the consciousness can vanish. The more you go into the jhanas, the more you see consciousness actually doing the vanishing. And this consciousness, the citta, the last thing which you hold on to, a self, a me, an essence, when you see it fading away, sort of, you see it cannot be a me, it cannot be a self. If it was a permanent me, it just doesn't vanish, it can't fade. And there you're watching it, you're experiencing it fading. So the deeper you go into those jhanas, the more obvious it is. But even in the second, third jhana, it's pretty clear, so you can't miss it, unless you're very dumb. Okay. Remember, even if you get into a second jhana, you're not necessarily even a stream winner. So sometimes you can get there and you can see it, it's before your eyes, but sometimes when you come out afterwards, you don't understand what it is, you haven't got the framework to understand it, you haven't heard any Dhamma. So without the perceptual framework, sometimes you just, that was a weird state, I haven't got a clue what it was. Which is one of the reasons why that I teach these jhanas. And sometimes I go out on a limb and get criticized for teaching jhanas. But I do that because I've come across many people, not just one or two, who've actually have experienced those jhanas as lay people, and they didn't know what the hell they were. They knew they were important. And once, you know, I can actually explain to them, I tell them just, oh, this is what a jhana was. And they say, yeah. And then I say a few other things. They say a few other things. We compare notes. It's the same as like, you've been to Serpentine. Have you really been to Serpentine? You know, Bodhinyana Monastery. You say a few things, I say a few things. We can say, yeah, actually, that's Bodhinyana Monastery. And this is what we really do there. So I can actually get a person to understand that experience was this or that jhana, and also what it means in this practice. To get, you know, look, something was missing there. You know, the will was missing, the body was missing. Can you get that? Well, now why? What's going on? So when you have the Dhamma, the teachings, the framework, and you have the experience, those two together means enlightenment is very close. Like, you know that favourite saying of mine? Nati jhanang apanyasa, and the last verse, yam hi jhanang chapanya chasa ve nibbanak santike. There's no jhana without wisdom, there's no wisdom without jhana. When those two are together, jhana and wisdom, you're in the presence of nibbana. Not just when there's just jhana, when the jhana and there's a little bit of wisdom, a bit of understanding how it all fits together. Then you're close, you're knocking on the door of Nibbana. So way Nibbana Santike. Yeah. Okay, it means that they do have the knowledge, they do have the frameworks, they do have the experience, but they don't have the ability to put those two together. It's a wisdom faculty, the ability to join the dots. Yeah, but they haven't got the ability to draw all the dots up together to get the full rabbits, yeah. Some dots, yes, but not all the dots. More powerful wisdom, yes. Sometimes they have a sort of a breakthrough, they see, but they've just got so much other very, very heavy delusion to swamp that. They're not that free. Maybe we can talk about that because there's other people here as well. And it's getting cold. So,
I will wrap up now because it is 4:30 and I try not to go on for too long. So that is the shorter discourse on the simile of the heartwood, and how, when if you ask the people of other religions, are they enlightened or not, say, oh, just let's not sort of put down other people, let's teach Dhamma what real wisdom actually is and how it's attained. And this particular one made a very deep, interesting division here, because you've got gain, honor and fame, you've got virtue, you've got stillness and knowledge and vision, but then it added the jhanas afterwards about being more sublime than that knowledge of vision they saw before, and how those jhanas again are essential for overcoming the asavas. And that's what the heartwood is, the jhanas and the wisdom based on those jhanas, according to this sutta. Okay. Can it afterwards, because we've run out of time. So? Yes, right, yes. Because it was the Buddha was a bhikkhu and he gave the discourse. Yeah, yes, sir. But because the Buddha was a man of bhikkhu, but there is a couple of cases where it was a bhikkhuni who gave the discourse, and I'm not quite sure. Do you know which ones those are? But whenever there was a bhikkhuni who gave the discourse, then afterwards they went to a refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha of bhikkhunis. There's a couple of cases like that. Really dependent upon who actually gave the discourse. Okay, so let's pay respect to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha now.